Shelly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
June 9, 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this, indeed, is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, Thursday, the second to last broadcast day of the week for the O'Shelly Effect. Last night, I just had enough stomach issues that there was no way I was sitting at a mic for 2 hours. So that's why there's no O'Shelly Effect from yesterday. Just to let everybody know, it was an unscheduled day off. Anyway, but it wasn't really a day off because I produced Donald Jeffries, I produced Bob Wilson, and those podcasts are out in the feeds, and more feeds to come. So anyway, like I said, it is Thursday, and who do I have with me in the first hour? Mike Swanson, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know, go to WallStreetWindow.com and check that out. It's not just about Wall Street, and hell, maybe a lot of it's not about Wall Street, because what is anymore? Okay, I know it's a big indicator for people that are in the know and have 401ks or whatever those things are even called anymore. I don't know. I have no idea. I'm not a money guy. I do know that we're all getting squeezed, and maybe I'll start talking to Mike about that. But in the second hour, kind of have a unique conversation planned with Larry Hancock, who is the author of many books and, of course, is actively involved with the UFO convention thing, which we may talk about as well, and also getting at some of the realistic research there and all that. I don't know if we're going to go there because we might be talking about January 6th in the second hour. So we'll put that aside, although that's going to be in the news today because, well, it has been in the news, you know, all of the pre-show work up to it because the live TV thing is happening tonight, unless you watch Fox News, in which case, I don't know. Are we going to talk about replacement theory? Are we going to discuss how liberals are destroying things and so on and so forth? And did I fall asleep yet? I'm sorry. Anyway, Mike Swanson is also an author, the author of The War State, a book I definitely always have recommended even before I got Mike on here as a guest or as a supporter. Either way, definitely always recommended that book, and also Why the Vietnam War, which is the first in a series on the Vietnam War with new information in it. And it's amazing. New information is always being developed by those that are actually attempting to get at new information, which is why I had a conversation with Jefferson Morley earlier this week. But if you haven't been keeping up with your feed, I don't know what to tell you. Anyways, Mike Swanson, again, before we go to hour two with Larry Hancock, Mike, first off, you were not here last week. How are you doing this week? And are you feeling the financial crush that the rest of us are? Oh, wait, breaking news. I gotta get to just real fast. Mike, hold your thoughts. Apparently, cops were sent to Britney Spears' wedding. The police were called. Does anybody care?
What happened?
I don't know. Breaking news. Nobody knows exactly what's gone on yet. You know how it is, Mike. When the cops are called, the story gets told later and then retold and retold. And by the time you're done with that game of telephone, who the hell knows what actually happened? But Britney was freed, right, from her contract, and now she's getting married again? Is it again? Was she married to that other guy? Do I care? I don't know. No, I don't. But I just wanted to throw that in my head.
I see your head. I mean, I had to look it up when you say that. One of her ex-husbands tried to stop the wedding.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, I'm not reading the details, but the headline says he tried to crash it, whatever that means.
Well, what is it with ex? You know, I had an experience, and I've told this story on the air, so I'm not going to tell it here, but I had an experience with an ex.
Well, maybe she's not the crazy one people think she is.
Maybe not. Maybe not. Like, you know, if I tell you that Homeland Security was called upon for my wedding in 2007, you might think, what did you do, Chuck? It wasn't my fault. It was my fiance at the moment. That moment, her ex-husband was the problem, and Homeland Security was deployed, and my wedding was actually guarded by armed FBI agents. But anyway, we're not going to get into that story right now. But you never know. Crazy ex-husbands do things, so is this newsworthy? Well, it's Britney Spears, so I guess it is. But how about the reality the rest of us live in? Right, which is...
Well, I got to tell one little story.
Sure, go ahead.
All these things combined make this story hit my brain. But yeah, I've come out of the financial newsletter industry, really.
Right.
That, you know, goes back decades, you know, before the internet, and
which we talked about extensively about 2 weeks ago, in case anybody missed it. But go ahead.
There was a newsletter writer who you know, was writing since at least the 1970s, and he got in trouble. I would call it trouble with Homeland Security, and what happened was, he was an I don't know if he's still alive, but he was an astrologer and doing financial interviews. And I was listening to him, and he had a big following because he was one of the few people who actually predicted the 1987 stock market crash. I mean, he predicted it, and it happened. And because he got that prediction correct, he got a great following from it. But he was using astrology to make his predictions, and whether this was, you know, real or not, I don't know if the methodology is real. But anyway, I was listening to him do an interview before 9/11 happened, and he was predicting a week or two before, because something with the way the stars were lined up, that there was going to be violence and, you know, something bad was really going to happen. And I had been listening to the guy off, you know, he was a regular guest on his show I was listening to, and he never had said anything like that in the 2 or 3 years that I was listening to him. And then 9/11 happened. Well, a few weeks later, Homeland Security, or whoever, the FBI, whoever they were called at that time, they came to his house, and, you know, when the person was telling me the story about this, the guy, he got really excited, the newsletter guy, because these people, he thought they wanted to listen to him, find out where he got his information, and, you know, really get into it. And the guy telling me this, I was like, man, he is so lucky that they didn't take him as seriously as he hoped, because he might have ended up on a CIA base, locked in a room, forced to make more and more predictions. His whole life could have been ruined.
By
the national security state.
You see, now, in the weeks following 9/11, they were forming the new Department of Homeland Security, allegedly, right? So, and a whole bunch of things in real time, came together. One might suspect that if we look back historically, we may find that a lot of things were actually pre-arranged to have Homeland Security together. And I distinctly remember Tom Ridge being declared the first guy to head the Department of Homeland Security, right? The former governor of Pennsylvania. But there are odd stories in the past of individuals who have come up astrologically being approached by the national security state if their predictions have been good. And I'm not just talking about, you know, the people that Nancy Reagan called to the White House, which did happen. By the way, that actually happened. In case people think that's, you know, just a bait for the Inquirer at the time and now would be all over the internet if it was happening today. But no, there are people that if you publicly make declarations, sometimes the agencies will have a talk with you and want to know how it is you knew something was going to happen, because there are varying stories about this. Some people say that they're trying to harness, you know, psychics and whatnot, you know. But we do have the example of the actual, even though it was a bit of a parody. Remember that movie, The Men Who Stare at Goats, right?
Oh yeah.
So you know, there was an element of that in the CIA where they were looking to track
that,
the mystical.
That story in that story in that movie was Army intelligence operation.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying that's my point is that the national security state in general, which to me encompasses a lot of things, it's not just the CIA, but the CIA is also sought out people. You know, how is it you knew this was going to happen? And this is kind of funny that, you know, financial news guy who's doing astrology, which, by the way, I don't think is any worse. No offense to you, Mike, because I know you did this for a lot of years where you're like charting stuff and you're researching and you're going, well, I know what's going to happen based on, you know, past models and here's indicators and all that. But honestly, I think sometimes these guys who are, you know, blindly throwing a dart at a board could be making just about, you know, the same amount of good decisions as somebody who studies, depending on the time period. I think in normal times, a guy like you is really useful, and a computer algorithm has pretty much replaced that, you know, or various algorithms, right? So that, you know, it's almost no longer a human element to making these determinations. But I think in the times we live in right now, roll of the dice, throw a dart, blindfold yourself, shoot an arrow. I mean, seriously, it could be anything at this point. So psychic, why not? Might be even more valid than that other stuff, because we live in strange times, Mike, or am I just talking crazy?
Well, I mean, if there is a psychic out there that's consistently making predictions, then, you know, I don't blame the national security state or trying to grab hold of him. Yeah. They were just trying to feel the guy out, I think, and see if he had, you know, some sort of inside information or something that, you know, a connection he had or something that helped him.
Oh, yeah. No, that's what I think most of the time when they go, yes, yeah, psychic, right. All right. Where'd you get your information?
You know? That's what they're really doing. But he was excited about it and like, oh, he's getting this attention from the government. And, you know, a lot of people would be scared to get that kind of attention. But, you know, for the way the story was told to me, he liked it.
I was irritated. I'll tell you that much. I was like, come on. And then, you know, and then they did a whole thing of trying to, like, you know, pull my fiance aside and tell her, you know, he's got a track record. We've had a file on him since he was like 12 years old. And, you know, and I'm like, yeah, great. That was my confirmation, by the way, of how I got my FBI file opened, which I had heard, you know, vague talk of years earlier. But that was that whole thing where I wrote a letter to President Reagan. But anyway, again, not about me. Back to this guy. So do you want to tell us more about that story, or it just popped into your mind and you just wanted to mention it because it's just one of those funny things you've encountered?
That's all there is to the story. It just hit my head because of the different things we're talking about at once.
I got you. Well, hey, look, and since the last time we spoke, there was a guy that approached you at something that... you know, I know he came up in a news story not too long ago. I don't know if you want to talk about that, but do you know what I'm talking about?
No, what were you talking about?
Well, you were at an event, and somebody told you that they were listening to shows.
Oh, that
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was...
I don't know if you want to talk about it or not.
Do you remember the guy's name?
I don't remember the guy's name, but the funny thing is, I remember you saying something like at the time.
It was real interesting. I mean, I spoke at this in 2017. Actually, my speech is on C-SPAN. I'm on C-SPAN. It's archived. Anyone can watch it.
Oh, that had to be before we went to the Lancer convention then, right?
Yeah, it was a year or two before that. I believe Morley spoke at this event.
Mm-hmm.
It was put on by the Future Freedom Foundation. Jacob Hornberger, who you've interviewed, he put on, it was before the one we went to.
And he's published a lot of cool books, Hornberger, by the way.
They sell really well. But I went to the Cyril Wett conference, and then he put on this conference, and the Wett conference was a great event to go to. And then the Hornberger event, you know, he's put on events before. And he's got a staff of people. They really know what they're doing. It was very well organized. And, I mean, he had C-SPAN filming it, if that too. I mean, so, but anyway, it was something titled like JFK and the National Security State or something to that effect.
Mm.
Jim DiEugenio spoke at it. Oliver Stone spoke at it. Doug Horn.
Right, right.
I'm pretty certain, Morley would have spoken at it too. I know I met him. I know he was there.
Well, I know we also ran into Morley at the Lancer conference. I mean, that was a busy year, 2017. Of course, this is all pre-COVID, if you will. Go ahead.
But anyway, two interesting things. People came up to me at this thing. The first one is the guy I emailed you about, and this fella. Well, it was interesting. First of all, when I gave my speech, Max Holland was in the audience.
Mm.
And he was sitting in the front row with his arms crossed and looked very angry at me. He just looked angry.
He does that to people. You know, he does. He has been doing that, or he had done that for like 15, 20 years. You know that, right? That Holland would go to these JFK conferences, especially anything involving Kennedy, and would sit there because he was a journalist, you know, allegedly, a journalist in Dallas, right, at the time of the assassination, Max Holland, and is also noted as a witness to the assassination. And he has always supported the official line. You know, this is for listeners' edification. I know you know this, Mike, but point is that he would go to JFK conferences of all kinds, even back to the days of the ass conferences, and sit there with his arms folded, like angry that he's there. Like all the, and I don't know who paid his bills to go to all these things. Perhaps, you know, he was doing well. But what I'm saying is he almost seemed like somebody sent him there and is like, oh, I got to sit through another one of these. And he would get angry and even make faces sometimes at people. I mean, when they were making, you know, more outstanding claims, let's say, he would definitely make faces at you. But the fact that he was sitting there with his arms folded and noticeably probably toward the front of the conference, this is his normal place to be. And he's a funny guy. He would just be there like that, like he didn't want to be there. So I don't know why that's important, but it's kind of, I'm just letting you know, don't take it personally, Mike, because he could have been doing that to anybody. Go ahead.
The thing about that conference, it was in Dulles, Virginia. Yeah. Where the airport is. Is a hotel, you know, right near the airport. And that, you know, I just figured, well, probably half the people in the audience are spies or retired, you know, government people, whatever. It doesn't mean they're all sinister or something, but he did something sinister that I don't think people really understand. So, you know, people like in the past, you know, or in the JFK case and probably everything else, at times, people have made accusations against other researchers that, mm-hmm. with no substantial reason. You know, I have no, you know, is Gerald Posner a CIA agent or something? I doubt that. Is Max Holland a CIA agent? I doubt that. However, he is the only author I know of, mm-hmm. that has actually gotten a medal from the CIA. For their JFK research. Yep. And that is a fact. Now, yep. what is people don't understand what he did, though. So he wrote an article way back when I was in graduate school, around after the Oliver Stone movie came out. Mm-hmm. And the article was published in the American Historical Review. Now, that's the most prestigious or important academic historical publication. There's like three or four academic journals. That's the most important one.
Right.
There's about 20,000 academics, you know, PhD people, professors that subscribe to it. It's the flagship journal. They have a annual conference once a year. Like, if you want to get a job as a, you know, teaching in a university history, that's the place to go try to find a job. You go to this conference. But anyway, what he wrote, and the articles are peer reviewed. It's the equivalent of JAMA for the American Medical Association, and he wrote an article in their journal. Attacking JFK research, and he did something which I consider sinister. So Peter Dale Scott's book, what's it called?
Well, one of them would be Deep Politics. Deep Politics. It would be Deep Politics and the JFK Assassination. Yeah.
That's the book. That's right. The book. So he, in this article, he attacked the publisher of that book, which it was published by University Press. Mm-hmm. probably one of the ones in California, but it was published by an academic press.
Right.
That book, and in this overview review of JFK research and various books, he's attacking all of them. He attacked the press for even publishing the book, which is pretty kind of crazy, you know, if you think about it. But what his editorial, I think, had the effect and was intended to do, and it succeeded, was to chill, create an environment to discourage anyone else in academia from trying to do the same thing or research the topic of the JFK assassination. Because, yeah, again, when this came out, I was in graduate school, and I was told by one professor to not study or write anything about the JFK assassination, because if you did, you would not be able to have get a job or have a career in historical scholarship.
Yeah, well, and even if you were to be one of these hired speakers at a certain point in history, they would tell you, look, don't publish anything about the JFK assassination, because even if you're serving the academic community, you would get shut down. Now, what's interesting about this article you're talking about, and I remember it only because it was part of a full spectrum, press campaign went on. And, I mean, literally, this comes down to accusing people who had written, you know, let's call it conspiracy advocacy books or articles or anything, of being literally guilty of harming, you know, America and stuff like this. It went from that, and that was in the New York Times, an advertisement, excuse me, that was run in the New York Times, right? Big, huge thing where it was like, here are the people that are guilty of doing horrible things. And it was JFK, you know, critics, Warren Commission critics and such. David Lipton was in there. I think Oliver Stone was in there. A bunch of people, right? And there were TV shows. All this stuff was produced, including a Newsweek article. In every area of journalistic release, it seemed like, there was a simultaneous and coordinated effort to counter Oliver Stone's movie. And it started before the thing was even released, as you well know, because of the stolen script and all that. I'm not saying that it was run by the CIA. Some people say that. To say that there was not a centralized agenda that was being executed with fairly good precision, given the media assets available at the time, would be foolish and naive at best. There was a concerted effort to go after that movie, because I think somebody had the idea that it might have been exactly what Stone described it as, which was a counter myth, and it might have been powerful enough to move people. And actually it was, but the movement we got was, you know, records release. We didn't get, you know, really true outrage from the general public on a massive scale, but we got some records released, right? We got the ARRB, after all. But that was only because of that slide at the end of the film, and it was just powerful that it's like, you know, hey, for 75 years, you're not allowed to see these files. What do you think of that? You know? And people got mad, and in general, even though that was about the HSCA and them not releasing their raw data. Stone effectively did move people enough. And therefore, I think somebody wanted to preempt that as best they could. And indeed, they may have, just to slow things down enough that there wasn't a general outrage over the whole thing. I don't know. But I'll tell you something. Max Holland is always seemingly right there along with the coordinated press efforts. He certainly was well-funded when he put out a book that I don't know anybody who's totally read it, about the Kennedy assassination. He was well-paid, just like Posner was, just like Bugliosi was. You get well paid if you get, you know, the right publishing contract. And magically, even if your book doesn't really, really sell, they make it look like it sold well with pre-orders and everything else, right? This is what happened. I remember Bugliosi's book ending up on the bargain rack. I've told you that story, right? Where it was like, you know, it was initially this big, huge book. It was kind of expensive. And they even put out a second version of it where you just get the narrative. So it's cut down. It's like 4 days in November or something like that. I forget the exact title. But either way, they put out the narrative because the book is divided into, here's the narrative of what happened with the Kennedy assassination, where it's almost a novelization. He actually, puts in there things about dialogue between, you know, Marina and Lee, which is shaky sourced at best, you know, and stuff like that. And imagines a lot of things based on the official story and tells the official story again. Then in the second half of the book, he pretty much goes after critics and their literature and their methodologies and etc. And you know what? Bad sign in there that he says that, you know, one of the only books that's kind of valid in a academic sense is Jim Fetzer's book, Assassination Science. Like, that's the only one that I recall any sort of praise for, where he said, well, at least he's using scientific methodology. And I'm going, how the hell did you get there? You know, Assassination Science is, again, a book sort of put together by Fetzer, but really written by various authors, which is actually what Fetzer was doing all the time, is putting together, you know, a bunch of chapters, let's say, from different authors that really should have been articles elsewhere. Some of it very useful, and we get to, you know, read for the first time people like David Mantic or the doctor out there on the West Coast. Oh, my God. Gary Aguilar, that's the name I was looking for. You know, people like this. Even William Law, I think, was first published with Fetzer, right? So, you know, good stuff and also some garbage, honestly, that he was pushing. A mixed bag, but Bugliosi gives a little bit of praise to Jim Fetzer, of all people, among the critics that he takes, you know, hundreds of pages just trying to destroy one way or another. And some of them with just, well, there's just, well, you know, the evidence of the Warren Commission stands up, and here's why, and by the way, you know. Anyway, I don't know how I got here, but the point is that, this guy would go to conferences, though, Holland, and I could never figure it out. It's like, look, you already got paid for your book. You're already a speaker. You already sell your autographs at conventions, by the way. You already do that because you're an assassination witness, too. You're not just an author, but you're an assassination witness, so people will pay a couple dollars for your autograph, and he would autograph stuff and get paid for it. But
he's
a
witness.
Yeah. Yeah, he's supposed to have been in Dealey Plaza at the time.
As a child?
No, not as a child. Max Holland was alive and all that. He did later on his book, I think it was called, what, The Assassination Tapes or something?
Yeah, I didn't know he's a witness.
Yeah, look it up. I'll go ahead and do a Wikipedia on him. But, I mean, I'm digressing into all this stuff because it's just fascinating to me that you bring that up, because it reminds me that I know he was present at several conferences, varying speakers of all sorts, and he would do the same thing. He'd sit there like he was irritated that he had to be there. I could never figure it out. It was like, why are you at the conspiracy convention, Max Holland? Occasionally they had him speak. Some people did. But, I mean, he was a rare speaker. There was various times where he sat, like, you know, at an autograph table, too, and would sign stuff. Anyways, go ahead, Mike. Tell us the rest about this. I know I just totally sidetracked us, but it's fascinating to recall all this stuff. And look, I don't know necessarily who everybody is that's an asset of agencies or whatever, but I've got my suspicions that, you know, some people get very friendly book contracts when they're willing to do the bidding of an agency, maybe. And we know that the U.S. government has attempted to suppress some literature, and we know that publishers became afraid at certain points. I mean, in the late 60s, Mark Lane couldn't get his books published first in the United States, could he? Right? He becomes, you know, one of the most notable and bestsellers of a JFK assassination-related book ever, but he couldn't get stuff published in the U.S. for quite a while. He had to go to the British press first, right? What was it, the Bobbly Head or whatever they called it? I forget. But, Rush to Judgment, and then later on, another book of his. When he finally put out that Last Word book, which, I don't think was all that great, but when he finally put that out, he was more of an acceptable you know, thing to first publish in the U.S. But of course, publishing had changed a lot by then. What was that, 2012 he did that, maybe? I don't know, somewhere in there.
Well, this article I was telling you that he wrote, I found it. He wrote it in 1994, this attack on the Deep Politics book. And I've got the first page of it. It's the University of California Press published the Deep Politics Peter Dale Scott book. And the paragraph is, the opening paragraph's attacking the press for publishing it.
Yeah, no, I understand. And look, there were coordinated efforts that went on before the movie went to theatrical release. Then there were coordinated efforts to go after, believe it or not, the DVD release. And there was another coordinated effort when that thing made it to cable, which was after DVD. I know this is antiquated stuff I'm talking about, but every time there was going to be more access to that film, okay, boom, you had, you know, academic journals, newspapers, well, look, magazines.
Let me ask you this. I had this idea a couple days ago. You know, in academia, there have been a few, you know, two or three college professors, historians, there's more in political science, that have written books critical of the Warren Commission. But for the most part, academic historians either completely ignore the assassination, avoided the assassination, or they support the Warren Commission, you know, very vaguely. And on one hand, I do think there is this fear that I saw people express several times, you know, and I think this Max Holland article helped create it. I mean, it's probably already there, but it certainly played a role in helping to maintain or increase it in the 1990s in academia. But possibly another, there's another historian I was thinking about recently, who's written about the Vietnam War and Kennedy, Frederick Loegvel, and he's also written about the Cold War. And with Vietnam, he's made the argument that Kennedy would have withdrawn if he had lived, and he blames the escalation that came pretty much solely on Lyndon Johnson. And he just came out with a book, the first volume of what's going to be a two-volume series about Kennedy. The first volume ends in 1956. The next one's going to be up till his death. But I was watching him do an interview when this book came out, and he supported the Warren Commission. Someone brought it up, and he's very dismissive of the possibility of a conspiracy. Or he said he has something to the effect that he hasn't looked at the evidence hard and hasn't seen convincing evidence for him. Something like that's what he said. But I wonder if some of these people don't want to say it's a conspiracy because they don't want to have to say, I don't know who did it. Like, they, instead of saying it's a conspiracy, I don't really know who did it, they rather just say, oh, Oswald did it. You know, they don't want to, they're academics, they're the experts, they want to show they know everything they're talking about, and the last thing they may want to do is say, I don't know about the answer to something as big as this.
Right. Look, it could be that it's a question that some academics don't want to tackle, but even when somebody who was a peer of mine became a professor, who I'm not going to name, but became a professor at NYU, you know, I approached him about this, you know, because we knew each other as teenagers, but he kind of knew I had I sort of kept things separated, you know what I mean? And you didn't necessarily, you might have known me as a musician, but didn't know I was into JFK or vice versa, except for the way I looked, this kind of thing. And I said, you know, I've been working on this ever since I knew you, you know, this. And some of these people just scoff at it, you know, where it's like, look, the history book is already spoken. You know what I mean? And this is the kind of thing that a crazy person says. You know, like, it's not within the realm of what's acceptable in academia. Now, there are strange contradictions to that. Like, Joan Mellon never had a problem working at Temple University still and publishing books that, you know, clearly were against the standard historical narrative. You know, Walt Brown, I don't think, ever had a problem getting a job based on his Kennedy assassination stuff. But Walt has written a lot of other things, too, on John Adams and World War II. And,
yeah.
You know, I mean, but even so, it's not like anybody ever blackballed him for it. He was, you know, he's able to get his teaching jobs in, and they varied. And, you know, check with Walt on that. I don't know his resume entirely. But I'm just saying that there are people that did remain active academically, even though they were engaged in stuff at the time. And the one best story was, you know, when... who was that? The guy who wrote Blood, Money, and Power, Bar McClellan, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So Bar McClellan had been consulting Walt for a little bit, and Walt had gotten a fresh, brand new copy of you know, that book before it was released, and he had already sent it back to him with a bunch of corrections in it, you know, and said, look, you need to fix this before it actually gets printed, right? You know how you get the copy. You do this, too, when you publish books. You get a, you know, the copies that are not the final, right?
So, oh, sure.
You know, we used to call them galleys. There's a couple other words people use, whatever. It's like, here's a printed version of it. Now check it out and make sure before we make thousands of these, right? So he gets one of those and actually unwraps it in his class, which is a writing class he's teaching. And he opens up the book, sees exactly the same errors. And these were direct errors. In the book that he saw the first time, and he said, you see this? My name can be attached to this book as somebody who, I forget what his role was there, but he helped McClellan. And he said, you know, regardless of whether it's in a book form or it's something that you hand in to me as a, you know, as a paper or a, guess what? Here's what's going to happen if you don't do your work correctly. And he threw it right in the garbage. Okay. So, you know, the guy was actively working on hardcore conspiracy stuff with other people for himself, the Deep Politics Journal, and still tossing, you know, a book literally out, something that he could kind of put on his shelf and say, I'm part of what put that together. And he's like, yeah, this is garbage because they're not doing their work properly. To prove a point to the class that I don't care who you are, do your work right. Okay. And but my point of bringing that up is that he was actively still able to get jobs teaching. Nobody, like, kept him unemployed or anything over it, which other people have said they were afraid of in certain businesses. Maybe that would make sense. But, yeah, it's a weird thing. And yet there is an academic push against this kind of stuff, and there always has been. So, I don't know. It's a weird thing to look at.
Well,
anyway.
Let me give you one other example. There's a book that came out in 1997 about the Cuban Missile Crisis, One Hell of a Gamble. And this book was written by Timothy Naftali and a Russian co-author that had access to your Soviet archives, old Soviet archives. And at the time, it had a lot of new information in it. And it's a well-written book. And it may have won some awards. But this book is the one that's got the story in it of when, after Kennedy died, Robert Kennedy and Jackie Kennedy sent someone to Russia. Yeah. I forget, Walton was his last name, but he was an artist. That Jackie Kennedy knew, friend of the Kennedy family. He was a homosexual,
right?
Like a bohemian type. But anyway, he had connections. He knew, he traveled, and I guess had some sort of artistic connection to people in Europe or Russia or something. And they had him go to Russia and meet with someone in the KGB on behalf of the Kennedy family. And they told him that they thought it was a conspiracy. And this story has been, I know it's in David Talbot's book, The Brothers, and the one about the, you know, probably the one about Alan Dulles he wrote. But, you know, this is where the story originated in these people's research. And so the Journal of Council Relations Foreign Affairs did a review of the book, and I subscribed to, or used to subscribe to this, and you know, I was like, well, that's interesting, I'll go read this review. I'd already read the book and it knew it was a really good book. Well, this review attacked the book. I mean, I was just kind of astounded at this. It attacked the book for simply having this story in it, and said it was basically unacceptable to put this story in the book. It shouldn't have been in there, and it's close to treason. I mean, that's just to me just quite amazing. You know, that's how the establishment, I guess, views just talking something. You know, one aspect of this case, you know, it just goes went hyperbolic. And after that book came out, every time I've seen the American author ever on television, he's always supported the Warren Commission.
Well, right. And, you know, I by the way, I just want to make a quick correction. No, Max Holland was not actually a witness. He was about 12 years old at the time, according to public information. So I do have that wrong. But why was I thinking of this? Because he was ever present in Dallas a lot over the years for various events, and had interviewed tons of witnesses. But he's supposed to be this very significant journalist on the case. He's been given awards, not just by the CIA, but other places, you know, for his journalistic integrity regarding the Kennedy case. National Geographic used him as a consultant. I just went over a bunch of information because I'm going, wait a minute, where is this? So I was incorrect about that. I just want to correct myself.
Well, but I think what he really is a freelance journalist writer. I think that's...
He's not freelance, though. He's constantly employed by different things. I mean, he's been employed by various publications over the years.
Okay.
But also, at different times, he's been an advisor and the chief advisor to various National Geographic programs on the Kennedy assassination. Plus other documentaries, he's credited as... I haven't checked his IMDb yet. Guaranteed he's credited with a bunch of stuff. But Max Holland is one of these guys who's always very much upfront about how... It is nearly insane to say anything other than Oswald did it. He's considered an expert by some people on the case because of the amount of journalistic work that he's allegedly done on it. But again, even though I don't believe he's a best-selling author, in a real true sense, he is also considered to be a highly credible author. He's written about a few other things. But every time the Kennedy case comes up, and there is a PR push against, you know, even when the documents came out in 2017, right? Which, you know, was a partial hangout in 2017. You remember this, Mike. You know, what did the cable news channels do first? They went and got people like Gerald Posner. And then, of course, you know, if you were a little more low rent, you might have ended up with Max Holland. All right? So they went and got guys like that and put them out there. Oh, there's nothing to see here. This is all nonsense, you know, pretty much. Until some of us protested, and they went and got other... And I talked to Morley about that, too, by the way, on Monday. So, in case you missed it, but anyway, because specifically, I know that me and a huge amount of people got involved directly in complaining to CNN. Directly. So, and by the way, they have a phone number. If anybody ever wants it, to be able to, like, you know, call them up and give them tips and complain, you can do that. But also, we barraged them with emails. Anyway, demanding that they put Jefferson Morley on, at least. Anyhow, and that was all happening around that time you and I, again, went to the Lancer Conference. So, was what it was, Mike. But anyway, now we've gone into all this, and we didn't even get to what you really wanted to talk about, did we? Sorry.
Oh, that's okay. Well, there's two, since we're talking about that conference, it wasn't the Lancer conference, it was the one Hornberger put on.
No, you were at the one that Hornberger, but I'm saying you and I were at the Lancer conference same year. Yeah. I'm saying around that time, that's when the document releases happened.
I see. Yeah. The thing about that Hornberger conference, okay, so that Max Holland was in the audience looking very angry when I spoke, and then after I spoke, I don't remember if it was immediately afterwards, but at some point after it, there was a break, and I was standing in the hall, and when you go to these conferences, most of the people are older people and men, really. Well, this girl came up to me. She's probably the youngest girl there. I mean, she's like maybe 10 years younger than me, something like that. And she was Russian. And this is 2017, and she said she liked my speech, and she said something like, "Don't I agree that it would be best for there to be peace, but more peace or something like that, between Russia and the United States?" And I just thought in the back of my mind, this girl's probably a damn spy.
Well, funny thing about that, again,
I thought she's probably a Russian spy, And so I just kind of I got away from her,
Well, just like people were like, "Oh, look, the NRA is funded by Russians." Not so much, but they did deploy these younger Russian ladies to a lot of controversial gatherings. To pretty much show up and by the way, push the line of, Russia's not really the enemy anymore. You know that, right?
Well, that's what she was saying. Yeah. And saying, because of what I talked about, do I agree with that and blah, blah, blah. And I just figured, not like a sinister spy, but they probably just, the Trump had just been elected, then, all these stories come out a year or two later about how the Russians were doing all these things.
Well, what was that woman's name? The most famous one, the redhead, was Butina?
Yeah. It was like something like that. Like, this girl was kind of like that girl, maybe a little bit older, I think. I don't, but kind of similar,
But it doesn't matter. If you're in a room full of guys that, a young man is probably about 50. I mean, honestly, you and I were pretty young at the Lancer conference, and that's not the worst example. And if you do see ladies there, they're never very young. You see young lady there, you're wondering who she's the guest of, right?
And this girl is real attractive.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I mean,
So, and they're by themselves.
No, at least, when Mary Mormon Kramer's granddaughter was with her, we knew why she was there. You know what I'm saying? And she was younger. Okay. But honestly, younger women, not really. If you're looking for women, don't go to the JFK conference, okay? It's just not the place to go. Pickens will be slim. And I'm making jokes, Mike. I'm sorry. But it's true, though. There were people deployed, and young ladies especially, and attractive ladies, seemingly with Russian accents, out to make the point that, Russia's no longer America's enemy. You know that, right? I mean, we should all be friends, shouldn't we?
But even though, I've written books critical of the U.S. national security state, it doesn't mean I think the Russian one is any better.
Oh, no, because,
I mean, look at what they're doing now, They're turning not only Ukraine they've turned Ukraine into a war zone, obviously, but they're destroying their own country, turning it into a worse dictatorship than it was.
No, they're not. Listen, all these conservatives out there, Mike, and Trump supporters, because they're not the same as conservatives, but conservatives and Trump supporters, come on, Mike, what's wrong with you? Russia's not the problem. You're being brainwashed by those liberals who just hate Russia. Don't you know that? I did it with a straight face, I'm sorry.
But I certainly don't like the direction it's gone in now. I mean, it's I wouldn't want to be there.
Oh, Mike, you're just believing all the propaganda, don't you know?
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I mean...
You know where I stand on this, for God's sake. I mean, but I'm just saying... This is what they push at you, is that, oh, you've fallen into, it's just old Cold War prejudice. And no, this, look, just because he's not your oligarch doesn't mean he's not an oligarch. And just because, you know, come on. I just, it's so bizarre to watch that happen. But there were people deployed that just seemed to have the money to show up at things that I don't think they were all that interested in. Kind of ties to the Max Holland thing, because...
And truth be told, I do believe that, I mean, I have no proof of this, but I would not be surprised if back then Russians weren't giving a lot of money for a few years to different alternative media outlets to try to influence them.
Yeah, no kidding.
Because, I mean, before 2017, I mean, you've made note of this, for several years, you would see a big push of promoting Putin and images of how great he is and how weak Obama is and so forth all over the internet.
Well, like people like me who are, you know, not in the upper echelon of the alt media community, I saw all across the board that a bunch of guys who were contrarians, basically, who, you know, were fed up with the system, all of a sudden, you know, it's like everything that comes out of the American media is a lie. But maybe, just maybe, hey, RT is telling the truth. Russia Today, they're telling the truth because it's something different than what we're getting in the U.S. It was almost as weird as, you know, Al Jazeera didn't have as successful a run. You know, when they did the Al Jazeera U.S. or Al Jazeera English.
Yeah.
But they definitely were swinging for the left side of the equation. The Russian media push and hiring all these guys like, good God, you know, like Lee Camp. Who was Lamar Waldron's co-author? Good God. Anyway, left, right, didn't matter. Jesse Ventura will take them all. Anybody who's got negativity for America will put them there. And I'm not saying I'm one of these guys who's a flag waver, but far from it. But that's why they took them on, not because they were interested in the truth. You know, they told some truth, just like our media tells some truth. Okay, and it was funny to me. It was like, I don't believe anything that comes out of American media. Russia's telling us the truth. And I was like, I'm confused. You know, like, how is it? So state-run media is no good. You believe that, you know, American media, there's the corporate buffer in between the state running it and, you know, it being a free press, really. There is the corporate buffer there. But honestly, you know, that's a free press, that... State-run media's free press? What about China's free press? Oh, no. They're definitely suppressive. Okay. So anybody that you disagree with, their state-run media is bad. But if you agree somehow with what's going on, then their state media must be good. It doesn't matter if they have the facts right. It doesn't matter if they're actually, you know, doing a full journalistic job. It doesn't matter if they're constantly engaged with, you know, here's Putin on horseback. Here's Putin playing hockey. Look at how tough and brave and wonderful he is. See, he's a great man. He is actually the exemplar of being the Russian man, which is an old Cold War thing. But, you know, here he is, right? The big push. And, yeah, as you said, at the same time, in that underbelly of alt media, what did we get? Barack Obama's wife is actually a man. We got, you know, Barack Obama's weak-willed. He's being controlled. There was a story circulating for like months about Barack Obama was probably being beaten by Michelle Obama behind closed doors, like he was a battered wife. I'm not saying any of this was real. I'm just telling you that this was the generally accepted consensus among anybody who was a contrarian. Look at how weak our guy is. And you'd hear statements independently coming out of people that I know weren't paid. Although I don't disagree with you that some alt media outlets have indeed been paid, but people that weren't being paid would go, I've got the weak sister over here. I would rather have a guy like Putin. He's at least a strong man. That was a real thing, Mike, and I was stunned by it and constantly confronted by it. People that had three listeners, people that were just talking to their buddies on podcasts, you know, 8 years ago, 10 years ago almost, they were totally convinced that that was reality, that Putin, they would rather vote, they would say stuff like, I'd vote for Vladimir Putin if he ran for president. You know, and I'm going, why? What? I don't know. Anyway, Mike, I know I totally wasted all of our time here today.
Well, let me, let me get back to what you, we got on all these tangents, and it started with...
I'm sorry. We did start late, so you've got about, you know, 5 extra minutes. So by all means, I'll shut up. Thank you.
We started all these tangents because you brought up this fellow that died. This article I forwarded to you about this guy dying.
Yeah.
So after I saw this Russian girl at this thing, this guy came up to me. Again, this is 2017. And he told me that he was listening to all the shows I was doing with you, or listening to your show, mm-hmm. all your shows,
right.
and knew who I was. And now he wasn't really overly friendly. And it turned out his name was Robert David Steele, and he was a regular on the Alex Jones show back in 2017, and he says, I don't know if it's true, that's why I say this, that he was a former CIA officer. I say I don't know if that's true because a lot of people will say that, and it doesn't necessarily mean that they actually work for the CIA. There's a financial author who claims he was an expert for the CIA, but he never was a former employee. He just like went to the building a couple of times. My dad was in the Army, went to the CIA headquarters once, but he was in no shape, no way a CIA person. He didn't even like them. You know, he just was there at one time. But there are a lot of people who claim this association, you know, because they had a weak encounter with them. I mean, I met two CIA agents once when I was in college, and I said, oh, well, nothing to do with you people. Mm-hmm. You know, that's my encounter. You know, I'm not going to go from that to claim that I was a recruit or some, you know, I'm just rambling.
I was important to the CIA. They were trying to recruit me. Yeah, I know. Yeah, I've heard those claims too. They wanted me, but I said no. That too. Go ahead. Yep.
Yeah, they just had a booth, you know. but anyway, so this guy came up to me and said he was listening to our show all the time, or your show. And he, as after 2017, he posed himself as an expert on the deep state. And then as the years have gone on, I'm looking at a bio of him. The things he talked about became more extreme. In 2017, actually the same month that I would have met the guy, he was on the Alex Jones show, and he said that NASA had a colony on Mars populated by humans that had been kidnapped as children and turned to slavery.
this child sex slaves on Mars, I think it was, right? Yeah, okay.
And then, he got, in 2020, 2019, he became close to the Oath Keepers and was going on tours with them. In 2021, he did a tour about how the 2020 presidential election was rigged. And the tour ended in August of last year. And then I'm just reading what's on Wikipedia. It says there are allegations after the tour that $3,000 had been stolen. And then he died on August the 29th of COVID. So he got sick and passed away around Labor Day last year, unfortunately.
Right. Well, I don't know if it's fortunate or unfortunate, I got to say. And weird guy, he was making claims that, you know, COVID was basically a hoax. And then he got sick and his lungs got weak. And I think some of the people that were devotees of his will now tell you that, you know, they offed him, that they, you know, targeted him with a bioweapon.
Well, I think it is fair to say that for a couple of years, he was at the top. He was becoming a you know, a guru in the conspiracy world.
He was definitely
one of the most followed people.
Yeah, he was definitely a celebrity in conspiracy culture.
Right.
Yeah, definitely. And not the only celebrity in conspiracy culture to have claimed to be listening to my show, too. They don't come on my show because I end up with other guys who make the same kind of claim. There was a guy, Stephen, I can't even remember his whole name, this guy, but he claimed to be into remote viewing, and he had formerly created all kinds of, like, freaky, almost alien technology weapons for the CIA, all this kind of stuff. He had done my show once because somebody was like, oh, you got to have this guy on, he's great. And I kept asking him, you know, how do we know any of that's verifiable? You know, like, it just, I tried to be friendly with him because he was on a similar network. And for a minute there, I guess people took him seriously. And he was a celebrity on a couple of shows, but hadn't really gotten to the level of this guy. And, of course, I very famously find it funny that, what's his name, Roger Stone, claimed to have been a big fan of the show. In fact, that's a quote. that I used to play at the beginning of the show. Remember the guy used to say on my opening, I'm a big fan of the show. That was Roger Stone, and that's what I recorded. The part of the show I didn't record behind the scenes, he was telling me all kinds of details, and I believed him for a minute, and then I found out that they had guys, you know, sitting there listening and taking notes and feeding these guys condensed versions of stuff from all kinds of alternative media. When he was advising the Trump campaign. So, you know, I was apparently part of that nexus of what they decided to gather, probably among a couple of hundred shows, really. Not a big deal, but I'm just saying, it's weird when you run into something like that, because it's like, yeah, I've had an FBI agent who is fairly well known and not friendly to me encounter me at one point and tell me he listened to the show, too. But you know, that is a weird thing. How did you feel about that, by the way, Mike? Since we're going just a little couple minutes over, I mean, that's ultimately the story, and the guy died recently. Some people have now even claimed that he might have faked his death, because I went and dug into it a little bit to see what people are saying. You know, either he was targeted by the deep state, they took him out because he was about to reveal something else, but he blogged about it. His lungs were just weak and couldn't recover, and he thought he was going to die. That, or he faked his death, or, you know, he'll pop up somewhere else probably as a radio show host, and they'll say that's him. You know, sort of like JFK was actually Jimmy Carter, you know, that kind of thing, where it's like, or Alex Jones is Bill Hicks, right? Anyway, I'm sorry, Mike. We went through this whole hour, didn't even get to what it is you wanted to. Are you going to be back on next week, though?
I won't be here next week, but I'll be here the week after.
All right, the week after, we got to get to what it is you wanted to talk about. Because, although this was interesting, I mean, do you feel, like, good about this discussion or no?
Oh, it's apt for what's going on tonight, that's for sure.
Well, isn't it? Are you going to get right off of the line with me and go straight to the hearings?
I might just listen to you and Larry, actually.
I'm joking. Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go there.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Support Chuck O'Chilly at Chili.com.
There's no money in it, so...
Yeah,
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And, you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model, too, and look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain. Okay, because people want to support you. They love you to death, but honestly...
So if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show. And I want you to do this because, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to Larry-Hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at Amazon.com.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Anyway, Thursday, yes indeed. And as promised, I have Larry Hancock with me now. Larry is the author of many books. And one of the most interesting gentlemen I have gotten to repeatedly have conversations with on this show. And I'm most pleased I bet I've had you on as a guest more than anybody else, Larry, haven't I?
Well, it's always been enjoyable.
Well, we've talked about every book that you wrote. We did the Larry Hancock collection. We've done other really planned series of interviews about particular subjects, a lot of them revolving around the assassinations of the 60s. But of course, you have many books out there that don't necessarily just focus on that. Surprise Attack, Unidentified, Shadow Warfare. Oh, and you've also written about, I said the assassinations of the 60s. I was about to go King, which you have written about as well, and a bit about RFK, right? So, you know, we talked about that, even though that wasn't technically a book that we talked about, was it? Nah, that's okay. Go back in the archives, check out all the stuff that I've talked to Larry Hancock about, and his co-author Stu Wexler as well. Tonight, we're going to get into something a little bit different, maybe not necessarily focusing on one of your books, Larry. Let's set it up. You want me to do it, or should you?
No, I think you should probably set it up. As usual, I'll provide the context, and in this case, a lot of background.
Well, yeah, look, what's in the news right now? Like, as we speak, the hearings are happening, right? The January 6th hearings, the debate over... Well, was this just a, as ludicrous as it seems to me, a peaceful protest, tourists, right, going to Capitol Hill there and just paying a visit and their disrespects to the various people in office, which I don't have a lot of respect for either, but I wouldn't have participated in what we saw, and definitely not under the motivational principle as presented, but that's irrelevant. What about protest? People talked about the destructive nature of what went on, you know, oh, it's horrible. There's, you know, half the nation's on fire during the George Floyd thing, which was overblown, ridiculous. And quite frankly, if you had historical context, it is ludicrous to describe it as even remotely as, as destructive as single nights were in the 1960s when things got out of hand. Also, even though we live in an age where it does seem like there's a protest everywhere, but I think it's just because of our awareness, I don't think there is as high a volume of protest, of civil disobedience, of, you know, today, as there was, let's be frank again, 1960s, 1970s, for sure. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that's ignored in the 1950s. I mean, yeah, we all know about the landmark events, right? We know about, well, here is, you know, the signs, the guy's carrying the sign says I am a man, all this. Yes, that all happened, but there was a lot higher volume, I think, in the 1960s and the 70s. And here's a surprise to probably a lot of listeners. Larry Hancock might know a little something about that. I would not think of you.
Might have been there.
Might have even been there. See, I would not think of you as a radical, so to speak, of that time period, right? Which is what everybody says. These radicals, they were all over the street. The anti-war protesters, you know, love it or leave it. You know, the this and that. Larry Hancock, the dirty hippie, doesn't work in my head. It just doesn't. You know, so I'm making jokes here, but the truth is that, well, indeed, you may actually have some personal connection. And let us compare what was to what is based on that. And again, I'm not going to go too deeply into what's unfolding on Capitol Hill right now. I'm not watching it. If you wanted to, we could tune to that right now. Me and Larry could just comment about it. But I think it's more useful to put it in context. And so let's talk a little bit about your personal history that I don't think I've ever heard you really speak about, except maybe vaguely mention that you could have been involved in this or that, but very politely, very subtle mentions, very nuanced. Tell us about your radical past, Larry Hancock. Yeah.
It's hard for anybody, or probably hard for people to appreciate the distance, something that you just said, Chuck, and that there was so much violence during the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s. I'm not sure that anybody could have grown up in it or traveled in it or been engaged in it without encountering some of it directly. Some of it you got through the news. One of the things that differentiates it is I think people at this distance tend to think of violent protest among the protesters. In truth, that was a rarity. If you start out with the Freedom Riders in the South, the integration protest, the voting protest, all the violence that occurred was directed towards the protesters. And we barely see violence. Now, I will say on January 6th, you saw the kind of violence directed at the police and the Capitol Police and law enforcement that you might have seen directed against the Freedom Riders. I mean, outright brutal violence. But back in the 50s and 60s, it was mostly channeled towards the protesters. Yeah, certainly when you get into the anti-war era, there was the SDS, the SLA, there were some bombings. But I saw actually a number of student demonstrations and was involved in some. And they were all universally nonviolent. The most that you ever got was a sit-in. I can remember being at the University of New Mexico when somebody decided to occupy the student union building, and some of us said, well, what would that do? You know, they're just going to come drag you out. And people said, well, they'll just come and drag us out. And we went, okay, fine. I did not do that. Didn't seem worthwhile. But there were marches. The closest I got to directed violence, two occasions, one a street march, participated in a couple of street marches. The major violence, and we're talking about thousands of people, bigger protest in general than you see now. Some of the anti-war protests were far bigger than what you see now. It didn't get violent until the teachers in a high school downtown decided to send all of their juniors and seniors out in the street to beat up the hippies. Then it got violent. And unfortunately, the hippies didn't see him coming. But the other personal encounter was on campus during what was totally yet another peaceful protest, just assembled like on the student mall, that sort of thing, when they sent in the National Guard, and the National Guard unsheathed their bayonets and started stabbing people. Saw that. There was no provocation. There was blood all over the place. Quite frankly, that's my memory of those protests, is that the protest in general involved large numbers of people, not just young people, but I think I sent you a link to a book called Moratorium,
yes,
which deals with a huge anti-war protest across the country and in Washington, D.C., with tens of thousands of people in the street and no violence. So we could indeed have large-scale, very focused demonstrations with no violence until somebody decided to go after the protesters.
Well, let me interrupt you here, yeah, because for context, right, the fact that we see, you know, the dogs, the hoses and all that at that time and all this confrontational stuff in the street, people must remember that even in modern times, there's a standing rule with the press. If it's not something where a lot of these things happen, and I can tell you firsthand that I saw peaceful protests during this, you know, summer of extreme violence all across the country. Again, not as many lives were lost. You know, in one night, in two nights to be technical, in two nights in Newark, there was more property damage and more life lost there than there was during the entire George Floyd summer. Okay. And that left a scar on the city, honestly. And I've talked to you before about growing up in Asbury Park, which was destroyed, and I don't even see, you know, news coverage of it in riots that occurred. But the thing is, they're not covering a lot of this peaceful stuff. There was tons of things that happened during the George Floyd protests that were welcomed, that were fine, that there were people sitting in parks praying together, all kinds of stuff. Even locally here in Macon, Georgia, I talked about it, that there was a protest here. The news media did not cover it, but it was here. It happened. And, okay, it was maybe a couple hundred people, but there have been many events that don't get notice when there is a protest. And, you know, because the media didn't show it to you, or because the media didn't decide to cover it, or because the media did decide to cover it, it's not truly a representation of the level of problems that might have emerged. And that's on both sides, by the way. I think that there have been efforts to not show police beating the hell out of people in an unprovoked way. I never heard of this circumstance with people being stabbed with bayonets, really. We all know about Kent State, right? But if it wasn't extreme enough, or if it wasn't something that the press was after, it didn't get out there. And that's on both sides of the equation. You know, protesters being peaceful, not really a good banner headline. The cops being in the wrong, not something that the MSM wants to push. And really, even the local media, local TV, local radio, local papers, well, why wouldn't they cover it, Chuck? Well, because they might have needed police cooperation for a lot of their business, okay? So how are you going to get access to the next big crime story that is a real crime story if you've already irritated and exposed the bad behavior of the police, okay? So there are many nuances here that can get missed because of people's impressions. And the people that think that the recent events were this widespread chaos everywhere, and it's just, you know, embellished. It's hyperbolic. It's exaggerated. And people have done independent studies about the recent events and even come up with, you know, there's actually like 90% of this, nothing happened. Nothing at all. And in a lot of cases in the 60s and 70s, even though we get the highlight footage of the anti-war protests and whatnot, the majority of this stuff was not violent, and you know, might have been a nuisance or whatever to this or that, because otherwise how do you make a point? But there wasn't a lot of damage done, life lost, blood spilled in a lot of this stuff, and I think that's missed a lot of times because people accentuate the blood loss, the conflict, the battles in the street. Now, is my idea about this sound, as far as you're concerned?
It's true, Chuck. And one of the things I think that causes that is the lack of ability to differentiate between demonstrations during this period, planned demonstrations, organized demonstrations, versus what I'd call reactionary protest, what following an event, which are a totally different thing. The riots across the country following Martin Luther King's assassination were totally different than the anti-war protest and demonstrations, which were structured. Yeah, one is a gut level, you know, throw yourself into it and I guarantee you bad things are going to happen, versus something that's intended to actually sway the public. You know, it's knee-jerk reaction versus an effort to actually make an impact on the voting public or something. And yet we smear all of that together. It's like the chaos of the 60s or the chaos of the 70s. Parts of it truly were chaotic when you had reactions, kind of like the reaction to Rodney King in L.A. And I was in L.A. at that general time, and it was very much different and very in any event. So I think that contributes to part of it is that people just smear it all together with a broad brush, and then you really can't get a grasp of what was going on. But I will say I'd like to make one comment that kind of, again, when we look at what's being discussed today in the hearings that are going on now, back in the 60s and 70s, the protests and demonstrations were not really part of anything larger. I think what we see now, and I'm sure we could have a discussion about this, is what happened to us most recently is demonstrations and protest simply being used as a tool in a much larger agenda, which personally, from my view, I literally consider a coup. Whatever the people think that they were doing, they're simply being used as a tool in a much larger agenda. When I go back to the anti-war effort, I don't see any comparison between the two.
Well, no, there isn't a really sound comparison. And let's get into the motivations here and get specific. Were you more involved with public demonstrations that were anti-war? Were you out there? I mean, because what year are we talking about here, by the way, exactly?
It's interesting. I was involved during my college years from 1965 through 1970, right up until the time that I actually enlisted and went into the Air Force. And at that point in time, that there really wasn't much of an option for those demonstrating anymore. Pretty busy. But most all of that, I would say, and if I kind of channel the people that I know, the channel into it, 90% of the people that participated in those demonstrations, it was very tightly focused. It was focused on the war, whether you were supporting it or opposing it. It was a small percentage of people that were focused on much broader, quote-unquote, if you want to call them progressive issues, social equality, racial equality. During that period of the late 60s, the demonstrations, and which is one reason why in the end, ultimately, like with the moratorium and the things that happened in 1970, I think were largely successful, is they did shift public opinion on the war. I just think there is no doubt about that constant drumbeat shifting public opinion. The people that were in it for much broader agendas were all over the place. Like I say, the SDS, in my view, quite honestly, it's kind of hard at this distance to differentiate the SDS from the Proud Boys. Mm. You know, they had a broad, not very well-stated agenda, and were just flat radical. Most of the demonstrators I would not call true radicals.
Well, a differentiation I would make is not a lot of them had guns, though.
That is absolutely true. Now, you might enjoy this. Actually, we did. If I showed you the picture from that was taken in my dorm when I was president of the dorm, on my floor, and I don't know what prompted us to do it, but there's 50 guys living in one floor of the dorm, and when we took the picture, everybody had a gun.
Mm.
And I'm kind of awestruck about that because I don't even know where they were at the time. But it none of that entered into the protest. Nobody was carrying them. Nobody was flaunting weapons. Nobody was threatening.
Well, I should have said, that those protesters weren't carrying guns to the protest is what I should have said. But, having guns is one thing, and deciding where it is you take them out and use them is yet another. I'm just saying that generally speaking,
nobody threatened. Having been part, nobody threatened law enforcement. They really didn't. I mean, there are times when you got in trouble if you didn't cooperate with them quickly, like at Kent State, you know. But, you know, in the broad perspective of things, you know, I'm sometimes appalled when I look back and look at Kent State and go, you know, here's a song about the tragedy of four students getting killed. Back then, that truly was a tragedy, and that's only four people. Look at the scope of the tragedy just among the Washington, D.C. police officers on January 6th, you know, and there's no song. It's different. It really is.
Well, since I don't keep up with everybody's musical feed, I'm not sure if there are any songs, but definitely not as popular as, the one that, of course, I remember the refrain, Four Dead in Ohio, and all that. And you don't get that same kind of thing today. But you do get, because look, there was at least a shared understanding of facts back then among the general public, it seemed like. You could interpret those facts to mean different things. But nowadays, I mean, there are people that will literally represent it as, well, Larry, you just made a ludicrous statement. Who actually died among the D.C. police, you know? Oh, the one guy had a heart attack. That might have happened anyway. That's it. You know, I don't know what to say to that when people tell me this, but it's
a type of denial. It really is. You've entered a state of denial where you just refuse to accept it, so you don't have to deal with it. I mean, at Kent State, you might have decided you're going to side with the National Guard or with this, but at least nobody rejected the facts of what had happened.
Right.
Now it's like, oh well, it's all just a coincidence, or it's And I will say, as strange as it might seem, there were dialogues in the 60s in particular between people with different views. I know that may be hard to comprehend at this point in time, but I think you just made a very important – nobody totally rejected the other side's facts. You might argue about them. You might argue about the government of South Vietnam. You might, but nobody chose to just totally reject it. So I can't talk to you, you know. And actually, there, if you want to talk about popular music, there are a lot of. It was captured by the fact that you could have dialogues. Mm-hmm. Now there were times to have them, and times where you didn't want to bring that up right in the middle of a confrontation. But I see it. I don't recall anything of the level of just outright rejection of fact. This thing we entered into in about, 2014, when Vladimir Putin, actually inside Russia, said, well, you know, there are multiple truths. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody has their own truth. And Trump began to repeat it. It's like, No, wait a minute. Nobody back then said, you know, you all get to have your own facts, you all get to have your own truth. That wasn't in the narrative. When Walter Cronkite went to Vietnam and reported on the villages being burned, nobody said, oh, Walter is making that up, or, oh, that's not really factual, or that's not – no, didn't happen.
Well, yeah, and look, part of the problem, obviously, is that we have seen our news media get caught fabricating things, right? You know, the guy who said he was in the helicopter and being shot at when he wasn't, right? Was it Brian Williams? Is that his name? You know, different guys who claim to have been present at things that they could not have been, and had actually, you know, released things without checking correctly, even though they've got the budget to do it. You know, here's the account of this person. It turns out that's impossible, or they misrepresent something. You know, we could take the current conflict with Ukraine, right? At first, you know, here's a tape of these sailors telling the Russian ship to F off. Well, they're all dead. All right, well, we come to find out they're not all dead. You know what I'm saying? There's been various times where it doesn't seem like it's a mistake. It seems like, you know, they've gone out of their way to support things without capturing the necessary evidence, right? I mean, how many times are we going to run into this problem, Larry?
In Ukraine, I think we do, and we did have it in Vietnam. There's always the fog of war thing. But, where you have to accept that, but I think what's really changed it, and I hate to be this way, but back when you had like 10 minutes of nightly news, you were liable, you know, editorial control was awfully tight. Now that when you've got a 24-hour news channel where you have to fill off 60 minutes or 40 minutes, every editorial control is not what it once was. You know, you can put a lot of stuff in there simply because you have to fill time. I'm afraid that's part of the equation. We have so much more news than we used to have that your odds are of getting it bad, or your odds of getting a particular reporter that has to, you know, sensationalize it. Or it's almost like we have, between all of those channels of news and all the blogs, news itself has become, I want to use that term, weaponized, but news itself has become less credible because there is so much of it.
Yeah, and look, the counter argument would obviously be that, look, even back when they did the film reels and they would sit there and reenact stuff, right, and claim that they were filming, you know, here's scenes from what was going on here, and we find out years later, of course, that some of this stuff was being fabricated, and they would say, oh, it's a reenactment, but they didn't tell you that. They would tell you, you know, here's the guy storming the beach. We actually have war footage, you know. Look, there's an amount of that that's always...
You can't beat the classic Richard Nixon narrating baseball games remotely.
Yeah, but right. There you go.
You can't get better than it. Look at that guy stealing home. Well, no, wait a minute, you didn't see that.
Yeah, well, but here we go, right? I mean, there is a, it's not just one thing or the other. It's a mixture of things. I think that the news media did itself a bunch of disservices at certain points by, you know, maybe choosing not to report things that they could have, and again, exaggerating certain things. And that's gone on across the board, but, you know, it's a very valid point that there's a big difference between we've got an hour's worth of news, which really breaks down to, you know, 40 minutes by the time you're done playing commercials and graphics and whatnot, to, we got to have something every hour. And you have 24 of those a day. And so you could say that this would actually make it so, even if with the best intentions, you'd have issues. But I'm saying that it's not just one or the other. You know what I mean? It's a matter of a whole bunch of different things.
It's not one or the other. And it's also, I think, one of the... to me, in comparing the times, we have completely lost the differentiation of editorial. Okay? I grew up here in Oklahoma reading an extremely conservative newspaper out of Oklahoma City. Okay? Everybody knew that. Okay, great. But even then, the editorial page had editorial, and you could tell what the paper's message was on the editorial page, and that was really clear. But then the rest of the paper was news.
Right.
And it really, there was not that much contamination. One of the reasons is because they knew they could reach people through their editorial page. Now, it's very difficult for me to parse news from editorial.
Between news being, contaminated by editorial and the fact that there's things like native advertising and, submission to the sponsors, and stuff like this. So, if your big advertiser has actually done something wrong, they don't necessarily want you to cover that. That might not be helpful to you. And that's TV, news, anything. Newspapers don't hardly exist anymore. I know some of them do, but what I'm saying. It doesn't matter. If you're sponsored content, you're not going to be hostile to your sponsors. Otherwise, you're not going to have sponsors very long. I mean, it's very simple. But look, I want to get back to, we sidetracked a bit, and I want to get back to this interesting history of yours because, it's fascinating to me that you're kind of focused on anti-war. I don't mean to say kind of, but I mean weird to me that, okay, I'm anti-war and then you enlist. Did something change? No, seriously, because look, Vietnam is still happening at this time. What was the cause there? Did one have anything to do with the other, I guess, is the open question.
It's interesting how quickly that evolved. I will say, again, remember, I came out of very conservative roots. I can remember my freshman and sophomore year actually taking a speech class and working up a whole series of speeches supporting the Vietnam War. Okay. However, within a couple more years, after actually having learned something about Vietnam, done a little bit of historical research,
right,
I was definitely in a different position. So I'm protesting the Vietnam War. So things were very evil. I know lots of other people that were like that, that started out just tacitly supporting it because that's what we do, right? We're patriotic. We're American. Yeah, somebody made this decision. The communists are evil. I know lots of guys who enlisted, and I hate to say this in a pejorative sense, but because they felt literally it was their duty to go kill communists. The equation was just that simple.
That's why my father went in 1968. Okay, yeah. For that reason, he thought it was his duty. And quite frankly, earlier generation Italians, I got to be honest with you, very patriotic when it comes to this country. That's been my observation anytime I've encountered them. If you're the son or the grandson of an immigrant from Italy, you are obligated to this country. Now, some people in my family remain that way today, even. But believe me, it weakened the overall family view after some service was done. I'm not going to go too far into that, but I'm just saying that this is one of these circumstances where a lot of people, I think, changed their view after they were exposed to either the war itself or they exposed themselves to a little more information outside of what was generally being pushed, I think, at the beginning of the conflict.
And a big change of what I talked about, that evolution, is you started seeing guys coming back on campus in 67 and 68 who had started going to Vietnam in 65. And they were coming back and they were starting to tell a whole different story than the picture that you had been getting in the media. Not just corruption with the government, but excessive, all sorts of excesses, all sorts of brutality. Mm-hmm. And they were telling it firsthand. I think probably the most effective, or one of the most effective things, and people should really, if they're interested, read about the Vietnam Veterans March on Washington, D.C., when you had thousands of returning veterans going to Congress saying, look, they're lying to you. I don't care what you think about, you're being told about the situation. We saw it firsthand. you need to listen to us. That was a major turning point. But as far as my thing, yeah, I started hearing from some of those guys coming back. But the other part of this equation was everybody had to make a choice because everybody faced the draft. Okay? Mm-hmm. You know, you were getting to the point by 69 and 70 where it did not matter. Very few people, and depending on where you were from geographically, most people were going to have to make a decision. They're going to have to reject the draft, go to Canada, whatever, burn their draft card and go into hiding, or they're going to have to go in the military. That's just the name of the game. So you had to make a decision. Hmm. Personally, I decided that there's just no way I cannot honor the commitment. You can't be here. You can't be a citizen. You can't take advantage of what the nation's is and then duck it when it comes push to come. So I enlisted.
Right.
Okay. I said, okay, not only am I going to do it, I'm going to do it for 4 years. One of my best friends said, well, I'm going to have to do it, but I'm going to go the short route. I'm going to go for 2 years, which he did. He ended up in Vietnam, lost a leg, long, sad story. Everyone was, I won't say everyone, a great number of people were forced into making a choice at that particular point in time, which is where I was. So I made the choice. And interestingly, some of the largest demonstrations and protest against the war began to occur just after I had completed my basic military training and was being assigned and in the event. But That's the other factor, historically, that people may not realize the fact that so many males of an age were literally forced to make a decision. You either had to kind of reject the country or go with it and take your chances.
Hmm. Well, except for those that maybe had the money to buy their way out, which, you know,
well,
some
yeah.
did and things like that. But that's always been the case.
About how you get into the National Guard in Texas.
Well, yeah, you get into the National Guard in Texas or, you know, yeah, bone spurs or whatever, you know, one of these things.
I didn't view those as real options. It just didn't. No, that didn't.
Oh, I know.
I had a lot of physical challenges, as my drill instructor constantly told me, but it didn't seem that I should try to leverage any of those.
Well, and just to be fair, you could turn around and, you know, get a deferment and then screw around with that because you're signing up with the ROTC and just kind of slip through the crack there. Like, now I've just mentioned the pathways for three different presidents. But anyways, yeah, between the Texas Air National Guard, where we fail our physical, and, you know, and all this, I mean, it's just, yeah. Anyway, no, unless you were privileged, right, you were pretty much faced with this, well, either you can retreat and therefore be, you know, somebody who deserted. And, look, it didn't even necessarily mean that you were guaranteed to be drafted. I mean, you could have waited to see what the lottery did, right?
well, actually, that's another. It depends on where you were. My lottery number was 347, which absolutely guaranteed you that you would not be drafted. My draft board did not see it that way.
Ah, okay.
My draft board said lottery? What lottery?
Oh.
Kid, just, and I don't care. You want 6-month deferment to finish your degree? Sorry. We need bodies. So... That lottery thing was inspirational for a short time, but not so much.
No, fair enough. I mean, look, my father wasn't drafted either. He volunteered. As a matter of fact, tried to volunteer at 17 and went in with a fake ID. and then had to come back when he was 18 once they caught up to it. But the thing was, it was about that at that time. And, you know, for him, like I said, we're talking 67, 68. This is at the height of this sort of thing where the draft is in play. And again, interesting, it did work a little different in different parts of the country. Okay. So back to your protesting, though. So now you're enlisted, and I guess your protest days are over, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Okay.
Especially, it's interesting. it's not that you couldn't still demonstrate and you couldn't still protest. There's no law against that. And I know guys that did demonstrate, or, you know, they joined in marches. You didn't wear a uniform, whatever. However, it sort of depended on there are other variables. You know, it just so happens I was in a career field where I had a pretty high security classification and clearance. You know, that might have, you know, I can recall telling during my intelligence screening, making a point of telling the interviewing officer that I had been in protest, and I was virtually sure that I had been filmed in protest when we marched in Albuquerque. It was really cute. I thought it was really cute. There were like maybe 8,000 or 9,000 of us, and they made sure that they routed all of us one by one through a series of barricades where they could be sure that they took a picture of each and every one of us. Mm-hmm. So, in any event, you know, there was also that consideration. You certainly wanted to be up front if you were, and not try to cover up and make it look suspicious. But fortunately, when the FBI came to my hometown to do its interviews, that nobody outed me.
All right. Well, fair enough. But to compare this to today's, you know, look, there's interconnectivity, which you couldn't have even dreamed of back then. You had to organize on a local level. Phone trees. You had to be able to contact people, probably write letters to one another, to bring people from far and wide to one area, if you were even trying to do that. But mostly you had to work on a local level, right? So you didn't have, you had to know people's phone numbers even to get them from the next town over. It was a little hard to do. So, you know, the advantage that you have greater access to people that you might be able to bring together of like minds, very different today than then. And yet, I think, it just seems to me, and maybe I'm wrong, seems to me that those protests of the past, well, they gathered more bodies for them. I mean, am I wrong or right about that?
Oh, yeah. As far as I can't think of, as far as the focused, we're not talking about a political rally. We're talking literally about a demonstration or protest on a particular subject, whether it's integration or against the war. Yes, the as an example, by 1970, opposition to the war had been so grassroots that you had people at all levels, you know, not just students, but we're talking about business people, corporate people, professionals, organizing within their own niches. And when they did this moratorium across the nation, literally, it's kind of like we're doing a strike. We need to let you people know that the bulk of this country is in opposition, or is in opposition to the war, in favor of a ceasefire, whatever. And then there were rallies in almost every major urban area that were in the 10 to 30,000 range, and within the hundreds of thousands of ranges in D.C. Now, an interesting thing to me is you don't really see that on a topic now. You see much smaller rallies in support of propositions or issues, whether it's you know, gun control or abortion rights or whatever. But none of those seem to be turning out, regardless of the number of people that support them. Okay.
Well, let me strike at the heart.
The same numbers or the same organization.
Yeah, let me strike at the heart of what it is you're saying right here and now, and ask you the question that makes a lot of people uncomfortable when I ask it. Okay. Anti-war protest. It seems to me as though there is no anti-war movement any longer at all, regardless of the conflict we're in. Regardless of the conflicts that we could potentially be in, there is no significant cohort to the protester community as it is. that takes up anti-war in a serious way. It seems to me non-existent at this point in time, as opposed to then. Do you think I'm right about that, first of all? Secondly, what do you make of the fact that there was a greater enthusiasm for, you know, being an anti-war protester? I mean, Vietnam, yeah, because of the draft and so on, I guess, you know, you could say, look, it started to affect everybody. Yeah. In a way.
That's it, Chuck. I think you've hit on the focus. You don't get, this is my observation, you don't get large-scale, massive commitments and protest until it affects everyone. People don't come out in mass to protest things that are hurting a minority. I'm sorry, I hate to say that. It sounded like, you know, they managed to avoid dealing with that. But with the draft, with literally, and we're talking about in the draft, and we're talking about opposition to a war that had been in ongoing for 7 or 8 years. You've already racked up, you know, 40, 50,000 casualties. You know, that affects everybody. Everybody's got relatives who've been there one way or the other. Right. When we went to a non-draft, essentially volunteer professional military, that was taken off the board. And I think that's been the big game changer. I mean, personally, I'll give you, we should be, and I was, embarrassed, whether you supported the war or not, to think that we were deploying the same people to Afghanistan and Iraq over and over and over again. You come back from a rotation and you go back. Why? Because we have so few people in the military, and it's not really a people's conflict. There's no draft. We've got the same body of troops, so we just keep deploying you. Right. And building up the PTSD numbers and the suicide numbers. Embarrassing. But because only a few people were hurting, relatively speaking, no mass commitment. Now, having thrown that out, I'll tell you the most recent time that I was personally involved in a protest, which actually did affect a large body of people and changed, at least for a little time, politics even in my state. And that was 3 years ago when the education community had been so defunded that literally the entire education infrastructure in the state revolted against the legislature and the governor. And we had, for our state, what you would call, you know, at the Capitol, I'm at the Capitol with, you know, 8,000 to 10,000 people on the Capitol steps, because it was affecting everybody, the teachers, it was affecting the kids, you know. But I think the answer to your question is the pain has to be broad enough. It was with the anti-war movement, with the draft, and a long, large casualty situation in Vietnam. It was not in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right. And, you know, the painful thing here, and I brought this up in the chat just a minute ago, but the painful thing here to me is that the reason I think that your point is so correct is that even though there were people that could buy their way out in a privileged way, you know, the volunteer military is really not for those that are financially comfortable. That's not who they recruit. That's not who they end up with. You know, being in the military is the best job that some of these people are ever going to see. And it gets them out of being, you know, part of a poverty situation here. Mm-hmm. And therefore, these are the people that are not empowered and, quite frankly, are not going to be supported by, sorry to say, but people that can afford to go away to college, that are going to afford to be able to influence the media, that are going to have time to do something other than survive and, like, go to a protest. I think it all creates exactly the circumstance where, yeah, sure, PTSD, and we can run people through the grinder because they're just poor people after all. And, I mean, nobody states that outright, but that to me is the bottom line. Is that, you know, look, the draft, it was possible that you got middle-class people going into the military. It was possible that, you know, a rich man might not buy his son's way out. It was possible. You know, again, we brought up some extreme circumstances where arrangements were made. But in truth, I think it captured more people, and therefore the consequence was more palpable among the general population. I don't think people think of it that way. You know, oh, we were all affected. Yeah, I think you got to think about it specifically. Who is less affected now is anybody with any sort of means, because generally speaking, unless they are gung-ho and really want to be part of the military, they're not going to go in there unless they're poor and their options are limited, and this is really a good way for them to have, you know, something in their future outside of, you know, a depressed area where you want to flip burgers or, you know, you want to sell drugs. How do you want to make a living?
It's a career choice, and I know a number of people that have gone in viewing it as a career choice, which I'm not saying that bad is bad, but I will also say I am a strong proponent of voluntary service, mandatory voluntary service of some sort. I think it doesn't have to be in the military, but I kind of go back to my core belief. If you're going to claim your privileges as a citizen, then you ought to put something on the line with some kind of service. So that just happens to be my personal whatever. But that's not the way it's working now. No. I think you stated it perfectly. For a great many people right now, it is simply a good career choice. And those are the people that have limited career choices, by the way. No, I don't have a scholarship. I'm not going to. This has been exacerbated so much by the lending situation in college, by the tremendous escalation of college cost. I mean, to some extent, that the cost of a college education and the bait and switch thing of college loans is supporting the career military. Because it's leaving a whole set of people that just don't have that ability forced to, as you said, make a choice of staying in a service-level job forever or really looking at a good long-term career, which can be had through the military, by the way.
No, and that's the truth. And I mean, look, you know, in years past, people have talked about why are there so many liquor stores in a poor neighborhood. It's not a one-way answer. Well, that's what people want in that neighborhood. Yes, but also the more of those things you add into that neighborhood, the more people are going to drink it too. You know what I'm saying? You're gonna create more alcoholics by adding more liquor stores. I mean, it's a fact of life. So when you create a circumstance, and I know that sounds ludicrous, but let me make the full point that, you know what, when you create a circumstance where this is a good option for somebody who has almost no options or limited ones, by default, you're going to create more people joining into the military because that is their best option. And who are those people going to be? Well, if those people didn't count in society to begin with, yeah, they might have earned a bit of, you know, like, thank you for your service, but they also earned their way into being what? Military, you know, GIs, right? Government issue. They are property of the government. They are now useful in whatever the whim of the day is. And look, I understand the necessity, but also at all times think it is relevant to remember that we should consider who it is, you know, our troops are consistent of, and how they are utilized. There should never be this acceptable ratio of, well, it's okay because they're poor people, you know? And again, although it's unspoken, it just comes across that way to me. Maybe it's just my, radical ideals. I don't know. But
no, and I wasn't, my burst of laughter wasn't at that point you were making. It made me think of another experience from my college days. I was in a marketing class, and we got a rather interesting assignment. They said, we got a shopping list. And they said, we want you to go into like 10 different grocery stores at these various economic levels and do price comparisons. And I kept getting thrown out of grocery stores because people could see what I was doing. I probably wasn't sneaky enough at the time. It's like, you know, I wasn't their regular customer in that regular neighborhood. So I'm kind of, here's a college kid. You don't trust college kids anyway, right? And what I was finding out was that in the poorest neighborhoods, the prices were always 30% higher.
Yeah, of course they are. And why? Because guess what? The people in those neighborhoods generally don't travel outside of them. Okay. That's why. And that's why, you know, the convenience stores that have things marked up. And look, it's very simple. A captive audience, you can charge them more. That's why, you know, what is it, $14 for a hamburger at Disney World? You know what I'm saying? You have a captive audience, that's it. And that is, in a weird sort of way, what they've created with the military at this point. You know who it is you're going to wind up recruiting. You know what it is they're going to wind up doing. I mean, it's down to a science at this point. You know, and again, I hate to point to Michael Moore, but I think it was in Bowling for Columbine, where he followed around Marine recruiters who guaranteed didn't go to the nice neighborhoods. They went to the poor neighborhoods. And they sold it like, you know what? You can get out of this. You can come with us. Look nice and clean and strong. You'll be able to make any career you want afterwards. Just got to give us a little time. And honestly, it's not illogical. But it is a bit nefarious in that that's the way it's set up now, you know. So I don't know what the proper compromise is on this. I mean, the idea of service at any level, you know, whether it's, you know, other than military service, doesn't matter. I mean, pick a way to do it. You know, and I'm not just saying Peace Corps or something like that. I mean, there's probably a million things that if there was a requirement for some sort of service, that you could deploy, especially young people, to fill it in quickly, to do a lot of things and change the equation regarding a lot of circumstances. But this model seems to be working for
me. It's also great for democracy. Just one other personal experience. Mm. When I went into basic training in the Air Force, my whole squadron except me was from, let's just say, the poorer reaches of New York City. And I was just coming out of 5.5 years of school, college. It was very educational.
Hmm. Well, there you have it. So, Larry Hancock, I want to kind of give you a final comment here because we have run just a touch over more than what I wanted to. But this is a fascinating conversation. I appreciate you letting us into your personal background, though, you know, regarding this. Because, again, I would not necessarily think of you as the on-the-street protester, Larry. I got to be honest. I don't think of you that way. I know that you would have those sentiments, but I don't know. It's odd for me to picture it that way. Also, I find it funny that the scene you painted about, you know, everybody's got a gun, but people didn't bring it to go clash with others in the streets, see? You know, there is a difference. There is a difference. But anyway, anything you want to wrap this up with as we get ready to close out on this interesting day. Of course, also same day in history, the USS Liberty attack happened. We didn't do a focus on that this week. But, you know, a lot of interesting things occurred this day in history in June, various days. So anyways, Larry, anything you want to close with?
Yeah, I think I would like to sum it up with, especially over the last few days, I've been hearing a mantra developing that essentially says, all protests and all demonstrations are the same. You know, therefore, you really shouldn't pick on one group versus another group because it's all the same. And I will offer you from personal experience and the audience from personal experience, no, it's not. Anybody who says that, you really need to look at them skeptically because they're pushing an agenda. All protests and all demonstrations are not the same.
Oh, no. Look, nothing is equal. And I'll tell you, the different time periods things occurred also have a meaning. The amount of access and the amount of information available about those things posthumously, you know, is always different from what's reported at the time. And we should consider all these things within context, which is usually what Larry Hancock brings to us. But this is outside of the realm of the many books, I think. Well, in a way. Outside of the many books that Larry has talked about on here, written over the years. Look, you can go to larry-hancock.com, larry-hancock.com, and see those things. Find his books on Amazon, wherever books are sold. I'll give you guys a couple of different links to a great many great titles. Creating Chaos, as I mentioned, The Awful Grace of God before, I mentioned vaguely. Someone Would Have Talked. I mean, it's endless. Look to the Larry Hancock collection in the archives on ocelli.com. Anyway, Thursday's done, and I hope you are not out there. I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.